I'd like to start off with introductions. So my name is Eva, as mentioned. I work on various projects in the Ethereum ecosystem and super close with DeFi. And maybe if you guys can start and say what you're working on and how that relates to stablecoins.
Sure. So I'm Victor Rorkvedt. I work with the RDAI project. And for those of you that aren't familiar, it's an open source, nonprofit money Lego protocol that was created by Francesco Renzi and Miao Zicheng earlier this summer. It's sort of one sentence pitch is programmable interest payments. It takes DAI as the underlying asset and it invests in no loss lending pools like Compound, DYDX, or Fulcrum, and then takes that interest that's streaming back to the user account and allows the user that holds the DAI to direct that interest outside of their own account. So you can use it to pay for services, you can direct it to charities, open source projects, and for me, it kind of constituted my third fall down the rabbit hole in crypto. So the first one is the one everybody talks about when you first understand Bitcoin and come out the other end and you start saying things like fiat money instead of dollar bills. And then my second trip down the rabbit hole was learning about MakerDAO, understanding how those kinds of systems, which seem incredibly complex, can result in this really wonderful system that opens up all kinds of new affordances for human financial behavior, and then the money Legos that are built on top of it are fascinating. And so when I heard about RDAI, I started building on it, and I recognized that it's not only a cool money Lego, but it actually kind of inverts a cognitive bias or sort of circumnavigates a cognitive bias that we've always had whenever we pay for things out of pocket, which is loss aversion. It doesn't feel good to see your number go down in your bank account, and so anything you pay for, you have to overcome that obstacle. So RDAI, when you can direct interest to things that you support, seems to alleviate some of that loss aversion. It kind of gets me spinning thinking about the different possibilities that you can build out a payment system and a payment network that is an entirely different structure with a lot more fluidity and a lot more possibility for supporting things that we think of now as these kinds of you need to add support models or surveillance capitalism to support. But with a directed interest micropayment kind of platform like RDAI, you really do have some really neat models that can come out of that. So I'm excited to build. It's not on mainnet yet, but that'll be a couple of months away. So I encourage everybody to check it out. Hopefully you maybe fall down the same rabbit hole I did.
Yeah, I'm Rune Christensen. I'm the CEO of the Maker Foundation. And for those of you that didn't hear it, yesterday we just announced that the full version of DAI, multilateral DAI, that also includes the DAI savings rate, is launching on November 18th. Yeah.
I'm Dan Robinson. I'm a research partner at Paradigm, which is a crypto asset investment firm, but I'm here representing my own views and not those of the fund. I mostly work on sort of research in cryptocurrency and DeFi, and recently published a paper called The Yield Protocol, which is about a way to do essentially secured zero coupon bonds on Ethereum. So, for example, one YDAI is redeemable for one DAI at a particular future date and is secured by some, say, ETH collateral. So, unlike DAI, it's not perpetual, and it's also not meant to target stability. So it's a way to get, so what happens is the YDAI trades at some discount, and you can infer from the discount what the implied interest rate is that the market sets on this particular maturity of debt. And so it's a protocol essentially for interest rate discovery on Ethereum.
Awesome. So something that's been really exciting that came out of this world of DAI that Maker has created is all these derivatives like RDAI, LSDAI, CDAI, but a lot of that has to do with the interest rate that people can earn, right? So these opportunities that, for example, InstaDAP is creating arbitrage between a Maker CDP and lending on Compound. But how do you guys see interest rates evolving as our ecosystem evolves? And maybe Dan, we'll start with you, given why tokens are a little bit relevant to that.
Sure. So yeah. So why tokens? Obviously, they haven't been implemented yet. But once you do, just from sort of the market on chain, you can get what the markets just for the prices of various maturities. You can infer what the market predicts the term structure of interest rates will be, which is basically the future path of interest rates. I think if you did that now, and this is a very sort of unjustified opinion, I think it would be an inverted yield curve in that I think people think that the current yields are going to go down in the future. That would be probably my guess. Maybe I'm not sure if the other panelists would disagree.
Yeah, I really have no. Actually, we talked about it yesterday, and like, I really have no idea what the yield curve would look like if there was one. And also, I think it would be really difficult to even construct one, right? Because we need to have a lot more liquidity in the ecosystem. And maybe once we do get to that level of liquidity, the economy has stabilized a little bit, and who knows, it'll still be inverted. Though I actually agree with you right now that rates do seem to be going down. And so to the question of like, these yields are critical for all of these like derivative assets. What I think is really interesting is that with the DAI savings rate that DAI is going to add now, this will be the first time in DeFi that you can get a type of yield that doesn't add any additional risk to the underlying stablecoin. And I think that will really open up for even more types of innovation like this, or at least it'll make people feel a lot more safe doing it. Because for instance, if you wanted to use something like RDAI and donate it to charity, if you're using Compound right now, you actually are like you're not just donating money to charity for free, because you are taking some risk, and there is some real non-zero risk that you could end up with a loss because of Compound having like a, you know, not being able to cover liquidation. And that's where the DAI savings rate is really interesting, in that it, you know, there really is no downside to like sending it out. So it really is like free money in a way that you can also give away and really have no sense or no possibility of a loss.
Right.
So yeah, also this is not the boxing match part of the panel. This is not what we're gonna be really fighting with each other. I agree that the rates are artificially high now because of all kinds of sort of one-time or ecosystem issues with the platform risk, smart contract risk, with Compound being unreliable, and the fact that DAI savings rate is coming out, I think we're gonna see a massive kind of paroxysm in those kinds of rates, and things will stabilize in a number of months, if not years, but I don't think that this is sustainable at the current levels, but I think that there still is a very high probability that these DeFi technologies will enable, you know, some sort of above inflation type interest rates that that can be quite useful for building these protocols.
Awesome. Yeah, I think something that's cool and sort of the elephant in the room is that the maker stability fee almost acts like a LIBOR today. And so people started debating, you know, how is the Compound lending interest rate dictated? And really, that's probably in proxy to what maker stability fee is today. Maybe, Rune, you could speak a little more to how the DSR will be decided and how the stability fee has also been decided lately, just for those in the room who aren't aware of that process.
Yes. So, right, so the maker stability fee is what you have to pay right now in order to generate DAI by putting a collateral into Maker. And it started out at 0.5% when DAI launched 2 years ago, and it stayed stable at 0.5% for like, I think almost a year, like very close, like in very, it stayed at a very low rate for almost a year. And then suddenly, last spring, it just like shot up and became, like hit a high point of 20.5%, I think. And the reason why it changes at all is because it's actually, so it's MKR holders, it's a governance of Maker that decides what the stability fee is. And they have like these weekly decision-making process that sets a new one every week. But that decision is made entirely based on data on the price of DAI in the market. Because what you use rates for is you really use that to stabilize the DAI stablecoin itself and make it as stable against the US dollar as possible. And this is actually analogous to how central banks that manage a pegged currency, they have to always modify their rates so that they can keep their pegs. And the very basic logic is that if you're if you want your currency to go up in value, you have to increase the rates. In Maker, what happened was that around spring this year, the DAI price suddenly fell below, like fell to like 96 cents or something. And what was happening is too many people were taking advantage of the fact that they could borrow DAI very cheaply and then sell it for more ETH and then get like better exposure to ETH. So the response of the governance was to then just increase the rate until people stop borrowing that much DAI, right? And So basically, like, the supply was going up too much, demand was only like staying at this level, I guess you could say, right? And then the high rates like pushed the supply back down to be in line with demand so that the price could remain stable. And what's happening now is the rates are going back down, and that's basically, actually, I think, because of this new dimension of dye demand, where people buy dye so that they can put it into compound, into like these derivative dye type of products. And that itself is then driving the rates down. And I think that really shows the nature of the feedback loop. Mm-hmm. That like, as there's more demand for CDPs and more demand for borrowing because the rate is so low, the rate automatically goes up. And now there's all this demand for compound and like for all of these ways to earn a return on your stable coins, and those rates then go down. And I think once we get in the DAI savings rate and once the ecosystem matures a bit more, we might finally get to a point where the rates in general start being a bit more stabilized. Because I think really the whole journey we've been through, like this extremely high, like extremely low rates to extremely high rates and then coming back down, that is like exactly what you would expect from like a brand new economy, right? Like it doesn't really, people are kind of like having the wrong assumptions sometimes and like trying extrapolating the wrong things. And over time, as sort of the market goes through this like learning process, things should stabilize a lot more.
Agreed. I think that some of the factors that dictate that are ETH price, maker decision making, and then also organic demand for DAI that will dictate these interest rates. But Dan, in your protocol, like what variables were you taking into account when you were building your yield curve?
Sure, yeah. So it's funny that there's a panel of stablecoins because basically the defining feature and the useful feature about Y tokens is that they're not stable. So Maker, you know, through a really, really sort of ingenious mechanisms, managed to achieve these two things, perpetuity and stability, that are really necessary to have a decentralized dollar and chain. And I'm buttering Rune up now because I think we're gonna come to blows a little more later on in the talk. I think what Y token does is it just abandons those. It says this is no longer perpetual. It's and we're not going to target stability. But as a result, you actually get by removing these parameters from the system and just letting the price float freely, you actually get the market to tell you what it thinks the interest rate is for this particular tenor. And I think that's useful. It's useful potentially as an input into systems like Maker or Compound to help inform their formulas or governance decisions. And I think it's potentially useful for somebody looking for a fixed term loan for a good amount of time. But ultimately, you know, it depends, I think, on having this kind of rock solid unit of account like DAI is becoming.
Interesting. I feel like this is the time that we should switch gears. So the hot topic is multi-collateral DAI. And so figuring out what is the process and what will be included. And maybe, Rune, if you have any context you can provide about what we know of how the process is going to be bootstrapped, that might be useful.
Yeah, so Maker governance is notoriously complex because we're really talking about like governance of a full monetary system. So we have this extremely dedicated core community that actually spend the time it takes to like, you know, follow all the sort of the most detailed research and actually even creating research themselves. So there is actually a very well thought out like base level theory around the whole concept of how we're going to do maker governance and multilateral DAI that has been worked on for years at this point. And the foundation has then like contributed a lot to this conversation ourselves, and then ultimately also just seeing like the organic conversation coming out of the community and all the ideas, and then like formulated a very basic, you know, what we call like an interim kind of like just like an initial framework that should work for the very early stages, right? And we're really just extrapolating what's already there, which is this weekly cycle that sets the rates in the system. And then creating a new monthly cycle because it's more it deals with something more advanced. So it's going to be on a monthly basis. And actually, in addition to the already existing weekly cycle, that will continue to exist, and that's how the rates will continue to be set in sort of in the short term. But then in this every monthly cycle, you have this like end-to-end process of like evaluating new collateral tokens and also evaluating existing collateral tokens. seeing whether you want to onboard new collateral and also how you want to adjust the parameters for existing collateral types. And the goal is always to try to get as much like as broad discussion as kind of like as rational and as little as possible of kind of like a popularity contest. So we actually try to, in a way, like actively prevent MPI holders from having too much influence at the granular level. So it's just like, you know, whoever, whatever an MPI whale, like whatever random coin that they like gets like the special treatment, right? But instead having it all focused on like always getting a hold of the data and then applying like models that have already been agreed on and then through that coming to like this common understanding of how we can securely include new collateral types.
Right. So essentially there's two facets to how you're deciding multi-collateral DAI. One is the degree of collateral. Something Victor said was interesting is having different types of ETH, like ETH as the collateral, but different collateral rates, and also the asset. And so the fundamental question is, should we be including trusted assets in multi-collateral DAI? And I know there's a bit of controversy, so maybe we'll start with Dan and your perspective on that.
Sure, yeah. So I think, as you said, you know, maker governance is an extremely complex process. And right now, it's as far as active governance decisions, it's basically just setting one number, right? And it's still like a relatively hard to get this right, and the mechanisms for it, I think, are still sort of like being evolved and improved. And so by moving to multi-collateral DAI, as you recognize, you know, like you're really sort of dramatically increasing the number of decisions that this process has to make. And in my view, I think that quite possibly increases the risk much more so than diversification maybe reduces it. And then as Eva mentions, there's also this there's risk, just you know, regulatory risk that comes in if you're starting to use tokens that can be frozen by a government, or custodial risk if it's something that's backed by an actual asset being held by a custodian. But I think maybe most important to me, I think, is the model risk. It's just the idea, what if maker governance isn't up to the task of evaluating the stability and relative risks of a really diverse portfolio of assets? And maybe it's worth talking about sort of what you see as in the future these assets being, because I think it's not right. It's not just on-chain assets, as Eva said. And I think, you know, I think that kind of risk is maybe what's scariest to me, because that's the kind of thing that caused the 2008 financial crisis, where, you know, the smartest people in the world had models that were fundamentally wrong, and things that they thought were like AAA rated debt were actually zeros. And going from valuable to just nothing, you see that happen a lot in these more complex instruments. I don't think that's likely to happen in a simple asset like Ethereum. So that's why I'd say I think when you see Ethereum to draw down, and we saw and Maker fantastically survived a 95% almost drawdown in the price of ETH. When you see this happen, like it happens gradually enough that the system actually is able to handle it through liquidations. Whereas again, if you were to have an event like the 2008 financial crisis, and a lot of this of sort of like, I don't know, like the kind of mortgages that you would have backing it were to turn out to be zeros, that seems like a more likely to precipitate a crisis.
Yeah, okay, so that was a lot of points, and I'll try to like, I mean, I think really the fundamental point, or like one of the really crucial fundamental points, is this like, this question of the complexity of governance and finance in general. And I mean, I think the most basic thing to understand is that risk is always there, right? Like finance and money is just incredibly complex. And just because you ignore the complexity or don't address it, doesn't mean it goes away. And there's actually no, like, when you think about like models and sort of like how to think about risk and so on, like the truth is exactly that, like there's never like any way to kind of like solve this problem, as in you just like make a good enough model or something like that, and that's gonna like solve the problem. In fact, sometimes thinking that you've, you know, the biggest risk is thinking that you've solved the problem of risk and now there's no longer any more risk, right? And in my opinion, there's really only sort of like only one sort of like rock solid truth that you can grasp onto and that you can depend on. And that is that diversification helps with risk, right? That's because in the end, if you think about risk as like, you know, purely in terms of black swan events, so like that you never know if whatever, Bitcoin or Ethereum or housing or anything, like you never know if it's all just like a big lie, and it's all, you know, it doesn't make sense at all, and everyone was just getting really excited about something that really didn't make sense at all, right? Or whatever, there could be some hidden financial engineering buildup that's gonna make it all pop or something like that, right? And if you assume that that could happen to anything and there's no way you can ever prevent that or like predict that, then the only way you can defend yourself is by making sure that you can survive that happening to like a piece of the portfolio of DAI, right? So that even if all real estate tanks completely, that shouldn't tank DAI, right? Or even if all of crypto goes to zero, that also shouldn't kill the system, right? Or and the most important, like what you really want to achieve is like a situation where you can have several of these scenarios happening at the same time, sort of stacking on top of each other, and the system can still survive. Because this, like, the other critical point to this is like, is maker governance up to the task, right? Like maybe even though, you know, the foundation has obviously been very careful in how all the MKR was distributed, and really like, and in terms of like the models and sort of the model risk and like the, like just like the methodology, the focus has always been on trying to get experts from the traditional space, but like very, you know, very broadly and like very diversified, but ultimately like at least rely as much as possible on traditional models, so there's just, at least there's something already there that can then be built on top of. But even if that turns out to not work so well, the whole concept of Maker is that when there is a loss, the MKR holders, they have to absorb that loss, right? And that actually creates this dynamic that over time you can see Maker as this like evolutionary system that rather than just like thinking really hard and like totally like solving risk and now it's not a problem anymore because we're so smart, which is unlikely to be how things play out, right? It'll be basically this like process of trial and error and like very real consequences of errors that then make it very clear that, you know, it is, there's a big advantage to actually getting it right and making sure that the system evolves in the right direction.
I guess a concern for me in terms of trusted assets is if we were to play this out, right, let's say using tokenized real estate from, you know, that was underwritten by an investment bank like Goldman, you know, the financial crisis, the problem was these assets were misappropriately tagged, right? And that's an incentive problem, really. These banks were more incentivized to do it incorrectly than accurately. And even if we have this very open decision-making, you know, transparent maker process, we aren't necessarily going to go all the way down to the way that debt or real estate, the mortgage was issued. And so how do you see that counterparty risk playing in, or Maker even maybe alleviating that? Like, are you going to start creating risk teams that go all the way downstream to how the asset was created, or simply at the level of what assets should be included in multi-collateral?
Well, I certainly think that that exact problem is something where blockchain gives us the best shot ever at getting, you know, very granular data. But actually, I think at such an important point, right, is that if you look at something like the financial crisis, it really was like the fundamental thing that went wrong was really greed, right? Mm-hmm. And like misaligned incentives, but more than that, really like greed and bad culture. And that's where I think, I mean, what Maker relies on in this aspect is like loss aversion, you know, like very basic psychology of like, yeah, you might be greedy, but then you're gonna get slapped with, you know, the entire loss that you create, right? Whereas the bankers, they knew that the government had to deal with the fallout, right? Which is this like horrible, you know, like perfect storm of like greed and bad incentives and bad structure and so on, right? You always have to take it back to diversification. So like even if you, whatever, like solve greed or like, you know, have this you know, at least like this clear consequence to being overly greedy, and you also like dig all the way down and you get all the data about the specific assets and so on, you still have to always assume that you might be wrong regardless. So again, the only thing you can really do and you can sort of hold on to as being something that is very likely to work is to, you know, don't depend too much on Goldman Sachs only, right? Make sure you also depend on all the other investment banks and also all the assets that don't even have anything to do with investment banks and commodities and so on, right? And basically accept the fact that many times you're going to be wrong but you'll get to learn from those mistakes. And also, on a whole, if the portfolio is well enough diversified, it'll, you know, it'll just be absorbed and sort of be a part of the general process of the system.
So I don't agree that we can potentially solve for greed here. I'm a little bit concerned that, like, if that's what Maker is trying to do, that's really running at a almost bigger target than a governance process could ever handle. And I guess I think of the financial crisis as motivated not so much by greed, but by opacity. Like, we didn't know what those things were. We didn't know who owed what to who and how these things would compound. And so I think that the Maker process could potentially benefit so much from the fact that it's all on-chain, and that all the assumptions are on-chain too. Like, how we're evaluating these assets, how we're looking at these things becomes a major difference in how the 2008 financial crisis played out. And I think that's my thought to your point, Dan. I mean, I think you're exactly right. There's no way the Maker token holders can be doing the evaluation of each and every one of the decisions that come across, you know, that they're sure here with, you know, what should we price this one person's mortgage at. But I think the idea is that we have a lot more transparency, and I think we build systems that over time start to have their own support networks, and they filter up in a way that Maker token holders are incentivizing them to filter up, right? If there's some sort of bounty for alerting the system, right? That's one way you could design a crypto economic incentive here for people to report up dangerous, you know, flaws in some sort of model, and it's a long process. I don't think we're getting there right away, but I think that's the sort of long range view, that it's not about making direct decisions, but kind of like how we're going to do the process thing. And I think, like, for me, the model is like Wikipedia. That's like the Maker token holders have become the mods, but they're not the ones that are actually contributing all the actual data of, like, this is what we're going to look at here. And it's a, you know, not perfect analogy, but I think it's one that is at least optimistic, right? That there is a way to do this kind of decentralized you know, project that nobody really thought could work and generate a public good, in this case, information, in Maker's case, you know, value. But I guess I'm bullish, but I think that we should be solving for transparency first. Yeah.
Yeah, just to be clear, I mean, I don't think that you can solve greed either. And that wasn't, I mean, it's a joke that, like, even if you solved it, that you still actually haven't fixed the problem, right? Because there's still stupidity and so on. But I mean, yeah, you can't solve stability, you can't solve greed. These are like natural human characteristics, right? But you're totally right, with transparency, with like proper incentives, and then crucially, very strong transparency around those incentives, right? And around those consequences. You can at least like, you can use people's self-interest towards something positive rather than, again, in the case with the financial crisis, the self-interest really was like just misaligned with the public interest entirely.
I mean, Bear Stearns shareholders were incentivized, right, in the same way maybe that Maker holders are, and, you know, it ends up being a zero. I think, like, you know, all the banks potentially were, you know, the equity shareholders that were wiped out or at a steep discount. Like, there were a lot of incentives there, but the problem is because of just the inherent complexity, like you said, of finance, you necessarily have to delegate these kinds of decisions to experts. And ultimately, you know, that reintroduces the same principal agent problems that you have in big banks. And yes, certainly, again, I think like a lot of the individual actors maybe at those banks were not correctly incentivized to act in the best interest of ultimately the shareholders and then ultimately the stability of the system. But that, I don't see how you get around that. And in fact, like in Maker, it may even be more dangerous because you have this risk that MKR shareholders, for example, could be bribed in order to make a decision that is maybe to the best interest of the attacker, but not and to their best interest, but isn't ultimately in the best interest of the value of the system or the stability of the system. So you have these new sort of you're introducing a lot of new principal agent problems there. And actually, these do exist in traditional finance. You can short or do derivatives to reduce your exposure to equity you own. But if you know this does end up like in some ways increasing. Right, a lot of the indirectness that caused the financial crisis.
Yeah. Okay. So, you're making like 2 points here, right? Like, so the first one is that shareholders and banks had the same incentives that MKR holders have in the financial crisis, which is true, right? And it to some extent, it's how, like, it. On one hand, it is how things are meant to play out, but I think also at the same time, exactly, if you look at like. The way that public companies are currently structured and like the way they exist in society, like the framework itself actually recognizes that there really is a major disconnect between shareholders and the actual management of a of an organization. And even, you know, you often say that like there's like a fight between them, right? And they're using sort of legal means to always battle over the resources between each other, right? And I mean, if you, what, like, I think the analogy of Wikipedia, like, imagine if in the lead up to the financial crisis, you actually had the technology that allowed, you know, shareholders to get sort of like a clear visualization of what, you know, what they were cooking up in there with like all those derivatives and kind of like, you know, for instance, just see something like, what, like, what's our level of diversification, right? Like, how much exposure do we have to particular things, right? And then ultimately, you know, at a much more granular level, individual decisions would have to be okayed on a, you know, on a recurring basis with like a, you know, almost like an app or something. Imagine like a shareholder app, where then they'd be like, okay, we're gonna do all these like new CDOs, and we're doing them like, you know, like here's a video explaining how we're doing all these things. Yes or no, kind of, right? Like that. I mean, I think if you imagine that type of scenario, and especially with like blockchain technology, and I guess also most crucially, like a very focused education campaign, as sort of like, you know, towards the shareholders, and combining all of these things together, I definitely think that you would have a much more higher likelihood of like, you know, catching something like this in the act. So that's like the first element of it, right? And then the second thing you're talking about, I think is very interesting, is like this attack of MPI holders can be bribed, because so now we're getting into crypto economic attacks, which is like a whole class of like crazy things you have to think about when you do DeFi and blockchain apps in general. And Maker actually has a very strong defense against this entire class of attacks, really, right? Because what we are, like, basically the, like, what we are getting into is like the point where MPI holders might decide that they're better off essentially abusing their ability to control the system for something else than keeping DAI stable, right? And typically, I mean, I think like the thing is, once you get into governance attack scenarios and crypto economic attack scenarios, you very quickly get into, let's try to steal all the collateral. So Maker needs to be built so that it can, you know, even survive like everything, like all MPI holders colluding and saying we're gonna steal all the collateral. And the basic defense is that there's always like a security delay on all governance decisions, so that they can be scrutinized to see whether is this actually like a decision that's just getting pushed through, completely circumventing the governance framework and circumventing all like the transparency and all the sort of the, you know, the data-driven models that are supposed to drive governance. And if that's the case, it very likely is an attack. And then in the worst case scenario, what you actually do is that you actually like do what's called an emergency shutdown. So you shut down the system entirely, and then you take the attacker's MKR, and you can like, once you have the system shut down, you can remove the attacker's MKR entirely. You redeploy the system and do like a migration process that's quite similar to how the upgrade to multi-collateral DAI will work now. And this is a very extreme scenario, but it really is like, I mean, the mechanism has to be there, because of course it would never work if you could just like, you know, steal a collateral or like damage the system just because you control MKR voting power.
So I think we have about 10 minutes left, and I think this is a good time to open up the floor for any questions. So if you have any questions, please come up to the mic up here. If you don't have any questions, we can continue. We have one victim.
Good morning. I have a question regarding the migration and the deprecation of the first single collateral DAI. And I've asked around a few times, and most of the time the answer comes down to the overhead of having two systems to manage. And I personally find that it's somewhat of a weak argument, considering the amount of money involved, and I feel uncomfortable with the fact that the system would eventually be forcefully deprecated versus the market choosing which version of DAI they prefer.
Yeah, and just a clarifying question. So are you specifically talking about that you think it would be desirable to have a version of DAI that is backed only by ETH?
Correct.
Yeah, so I mean, so the first part of the question, right? It's really like, the thing is that there are level of like security measures and especially cryptoeconomic defense solutions built into the multilateral DAI code base. That just means that over time, it really makes no sense to hold on to like the single lateral DAI. Even though single lateral DAI, it's been incredibly security tested, right? It's been battle tested for years at this point. But you know, the multilateral DAI code base is actually older than the single lateral DAI code base. Like multilateral DAI has gone through this incredibly long, like multi-year research and development process that has produced like some, you know, like code with a level of sort of security as like principles that are, you know, an order of magnitude better than what you have in single lateral DAI. So from a technical perspective, it really is like, if you want to look at like a time scale of decades, it really makes a lot more sense to rely on the MCD code base. But then to the second point about the fact that there might be demand for a stablecoin that's only backed by ETH, I mean, this is something that we started really coming up in the community once, basically a broader group than just like the people who are involved in Maker Governance started realizing that Maker Governance had for years been, you know, figuring out how can we scale the DAI supply and how we needed real world assets for that. And this a solution that was proposed by, I mean, actually some guy on Twitter in this conversation was that because Maker will support synthetic assets anyway, right? So there'll also be like a Euro stablecoin and Maker Governance can actually create whatever kind of synthetic asset they want. That means they could also create a new asset, so like a new single collateral DAI, which then right now I refer to that as a purity DAI, right? So like a new stablecoin that's backed only by ETH, but using the multilateral DAI framework, so it has all those advantages of security and also something like the DAI savings rate and these kind of the full set of features. And so I think that if there really turns out to be a critical mass of demand for that, then it'll be trivially easy for Maker Governance to create a follow-up single lateral DAI. And then another thing to consider is a single lateral DAI will actually continue to run in the background for quite a while, even after the multilateral DAI launches. Although much of liquidity will probably immediately move to multilateral DAI, like it's not gonna be forcefully go away immediately. So I think in the end, as long as there's enough demand there, it'll be possible for people to stay with the kind of stablecoin they want.
And if I understand the way the system works correctly, I think you are free to make a proposal to the Maker multi-collateral DAI system to make this single collateral ETH-based one. So, you know, it's not something that you have to rely on Maker making that call. You can also participate.
Thank you.
If there are any other questions, I guess if we are simulating a world where we are using off-chain assets, which assets would we use? And maybe we have different perspectives on that.
I mean, I think I think what's cool to look at is the actual proposals and actual collaborations that the foundation at least has been looking at recently. One really cool example is Paperchain. So this is a blockchain startup that's tokenizing royalties for music artists that are selling music on Spotify. And if you're not a really big shot musician, you actually have a lot of issues with how do you even finance your Neo recording and all this stuff. There were not very good infrastructure for people who weren't at the very high level. And so this startup is trying to solve that issue by enabling them to tokenize, you know, the claim on their future royalties for something like Spotify. And then this asset can actually, and that's actually gonna be a digital EC20 token that will fit straight into Maker. And I think that's a really cool example of some very, you know, very out there type of exposure that is incredibly, you know, it's it creates a lot of diversity, obviously, compared to something like just having it all be real estate or having it all be crypto. But then beyond that, I mean, real estate, there's several startups that are trying to figure out how to get real estate into multilateral DAI over, you know, I mean, it's a long journey because of all the regulation that's involved, of course. And the same goes for portray finance. And there's actually also, and I think this is pretty cool, there's like Fluidity, the creators of AirSwap. They have completely on their own, without any sort of, like without any sort of collaboration or involvement from the Mega Foundation, create their own, like their whole like own stack and proposal and kind of like approach of how they want to introduce T-bills as collateral, especially in order to like generate sufficient liquidity for DAI and like enable it to like scale in a much more elastic fashion when there's like big swings in the market.
Right. That's really interesting. Dan, did you have a perspective?
Yeah, so I mean, I think real estate, I certainly see the demand for borrowing against real estate, but I think there's, you know, there's very clear sort of like systemic risks around it. And in fact, I think like, you know, practically every credit crisis ever has been driven by some kind of real estate bubble and borrowing against and leveraging real estate. And so I think there's that risk. Again, I understand the points about diversification, but ultimately, like quite often when such a crisis happens, it hits the whole sector, it hits everything. Weirdly enough, I think again, like when you if you actually just are tied to an asset like Ether, I think we've seen that even like sort of a dramatic fall in the price of Ether over the course of a year was perfectly fine for a single collateral DAI. I don't think we've ever seen a case where you've had like a commodity crash like that fast, or have a crisis or a boom or a bubble driven just by like a single commodity's price. And so I think that's part of, I suppose, my argument for why sort of arguably not diversifying at all makes more sense from a risk perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point that most credit bubbles in the past have been based in real estate. And I also think what's especially interesting to look at is how the financial crisis was really this example of like a crash that really, where it really, you know, it wasn't like the Ethereum crash that DAI survived, right? It really was like a 1-0 type of crash. But I mean, there are also examples of crashes that had nothing to do with real estate. And I think the one that's most relevant for crypto is obviously the .com crash, right? And the thing is, the problem with tying DAI only to ETH and like creating a stable coin and creating like a monetary system that's based only on like a, you know, something that is a, like it's a little bit equivalent to like a tech stock, right? Like, I mean, like a tech asset, right? Is that what you're essentially doing is you're like taking it. I mean, okay, this is very, very simplified, right? But imagine if you took the same dynamic of like CDOs and derivatives upon derivatives upon derivatives that had been applied to real estate in the financial crisis. Imagine if that had somehow been applied to like tech stocks in the .com bubble, right? Like, because then that would have, could possibly have been even more insane and violent than the .com bubble already was, right? So in the end, I mean, I think this dynamic of like, actually, I think a really critical point is that like things only really ever go wrong when finance kind of like starts putting the cart before the horse, right? And that's the problem with a decentralized stablecoin or like a single collateralized stablecoin is that it works great when ETH is kind of like driving the show, right? And like DAI is kind of like relying on ETH for its value. But if we end up in a situation where ETH is suddenly being like propped up by DAI, because DAI is now like this big monetary system and it's creating all this like it's channeling all this credit into Ethereum, and that way you actually end up with it, like with DAI driving the Ethereum price instead of Ethereum like driving or stabilizing the DAI price, then that's when if the market starts turning and the Ethereum price starts falling, or if just the DAI supply starts shrinking because it turns out there's a better stablecoin or something like that, that's when you can get what's referred to as a death spiral, where, you know, as the Ethereum price falls, the DAI supply shrinks because of liquidations, and because the DAI, like DAI is driving the ETH price, as the DAI supply shrinks, ETH falls even more. And that's when you can get that kind of like 1-0 2007, where real estate turns out to be worthless, type of scenario. And again, the only known way to deal with this is to assume that it'll happen at some point and diversify as much as possible.
So a happy medium, the way I'm seeing that is, you know, you can diversify and also maybe have on-chain assets when we can have other crypto assets on Ethereum. So things like TBTC, once that's live, that might be really interesting to put in multi-collateral DAI. I think our time is up, so thank you all for joining us this early morning, and hope you can follow the multi-collateral DAI process. Thank you. Thank you.